Good evening, and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Just for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author, Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African-American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Hello, Blog Talk family. We have a great show tonight. We have on the line Mr. John Franklin from the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Certainly. I am Director of Partnerships and International Programs at the Smithsonian's newest museum. We're currently under construction, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, currently under construction at the base of the Washington Monument around the corner from the White House. We are attempting in our plans and our current programs, our current exhibitions, to explain the history of and culture of African Americans in many ways, through the building that we are constructing, through exhibitions that we currently have on display and traveling the country, as well as through programs that we do. We feel that it's very important for people to understand the history of African Americans in an international context. We are familiar with the different dates of emancipation in the United States, the official dates. We celebrated this past Monday the 150th anniversary to the day of President Lincoln's decision to free the enslaved people of Washington, D.C. A book about it is called First Freed because they are the first freed by presidential decree. Later, we have later that at the end of that year, January 1st, 1863, President Lincoln signs the Emancipation Proclamation. And then in some of the territories, such as Texas and Florida, they learn even later that people are free. But at the same time that these actual decrees are occurring, people are freeing themselves and seeking freedom, purchasing the freedom of their relatives, running away to freedom. Some are emancipated at the death of their owners. But we feel it's an opportunity to educate the public about the history of Washington in particular, and that Washington was a city, the center of democracy, that housed slave trading, had enslaved people involved in the construction of the U.S. Capitol, of the White House, and of many of the structures that remain to this day in Washington. And it's kind of a hidden story. It's there. Those of us who studied Washington know it. But Washington at times considers itself an international city and does not always recognize its deeply southern roots. I have a very interesting map that I'd love to share with you and your listeners of Washington in 1792 when it was all plantation. If you recall, our first capitals were Philadelphia and New York. And the decision was made in 1793 to build a new capital in what was southern Maryland and a tip of Virginia. And this map shows the area that is transformed into Washington, D.C. as tracts of plantation with the names like Mount Pleasant, Jamaica, Port Royal, Beale's Levels, Mexico, Hopyard,
okay,
and the
before
name.
Before you continue, can I ask a question?
And the names of the owners.
There's a picture we posted on Facebook. When I say we, Leslie Gist and the Just for Freedom. A picture of an emancipation celebration, and the picture received over 1,000 hits and 300 shares within 48 hours.
Right.
Are you familiar
That's
with
probably the celebration from 1866?
This one is 1916.
Okay.
Okay. Are you familiar with this holiday? And why do you think so many people are fascinated with these women who are all over 100 years old, four of them, at this celebration, which were once enslaved?
Well, immediately following the freeing of the 3,011 slaves in Washington, in subsequent years, each year, the African American community celebrated the Emancipation Day, which was April 16th. And shortly, probably after the photograph that you posted, the celebrations ended and they were revived about 10 years ago by the current city council. And they created a commission on which I serve to look at how to celebrate and educate the Washington public about this part of our history each year. So over the course of the past 5 years, I've done three different programs. Last night I moderated a panel discussion of four scholars who are all specialists in the history of Washington who helped us understand how this emancipation unfolded.
Now, what is the difference between Emancipation Day, Juneteenth, and Jubilee?
Okay. Juneteenth celebrates the day when people in Texas learned that they were free. And that has been become a holiday that's been celebrated beyond Texas. Jubilee is celebrating freedom, whether it is on any of these specific dates or just celebrating the transition from enslavement to freedom. And Emancipation Day is different days in different places. In Washington, April 16th. The Emancipation Proclamation is January 1st. And I opened the program last night showing a map of North America, Central America, the Caribbean, and South America, because emancipation occurs in different years and different dates from Chile to Canada. So depending on where you are, emancipation occurs at different times.
Right. Now, I celebrated Emancipation Week in Canada two summers ago. Could you expound on the emancipation celebration in Canada?
Yes. The British colonies, whether they were Jamaica, Canada, Bermuda, Bahamas, British Guyana, all celebrated August 1st, 1833. And so throughout the Commonwealth, throughout the Caribbean, in the British-speaking areas, August 1st is Emancipation Day. The French abolished slavery twice. At the time of the French Revolution in 1789, and then Napoleon is married to a sugar planter, Empress Josephine in Martinique, and he re-establishes slavery in 1802, and it is abolished a second time in 1848. The last place in this hemisphere to abolish slavery is Brazil in 1888, and just before that in Cuba in 1886. So it's important for us to understand that all of these countries had slavery, and they have freed their enslaved people at different times.
Okay. So what would be great, what would be a ideal celebration? Do you think there should be a universal Emancipation Day, where something similar to what they do in New Orleans with the Mardi Gras, where you acknowledge all of these different celebrations around the world?
I don't know if Mardi Gras is the example, but I think it's important for people to understand that those of us who now live in the United States come from these different countries that have different history. And it's important for us to know each other's history. The Jamaicans know their history, but they may not know the history from the Spanish-speaking areas. The people from the French areas don't necessarily know what happened in Brazil. So each anniversary is an opportunity for us to educate our fellow citizens.
So do you think there should be a universal celebration in this country, like maybe a freedom holiday?
I've never considered it before, but it's an idea we could certainly contemplate.
Okay. Which country, and I've just been curious for years, which country practiced slavery the longest? I know you mentioned when they abolished it. But which one, because it's in my opinion, I have no facts to base it on, but it's in my opinion that America, not, you know, when America was formed in 1776, was one of the last ones to have slavery and one of the first ones to end it. But, you know, I like to have a comparison. Which country practiced it the longest and which one practiced slavery the shortest and who abolished it first?
Well, the earliest Africans brought here, both free and enslaved, are brought by the Spanish in 1513 to Florida. Now, Florida doesn't become part of the United States.
At that point, right?
Florida doesn't become part of the United States until 300 years later.
Okay.
But Africans were there enslaved and free for 300 years in Florida before it becomes part of the United States.
Wow.
So the earliest is the Spanish bringing Africans to Puerto Rico, to Cuba, to various countries in South America. The last country in this hemisphere to abolish slavery is Brazil in 1888. However, slavery continues in a formal way in West Africa, in Mauritania, until 1981. I was living in Senegal, a neighboring country, when the slaves in Mauritania were informed that they were free.
How long was slavery in practice in Brazil? I know you said 1888, it was abolished.
Right.
How long?
The Portuguese bring the first Africans also very in the middle of the 1500s.
Wow.
To Brazil.
And West Africa. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Right. In West Africa, in many parts of Africa, there's a form of traditional domestic slavery that in some cases continues to this day. Young people who are given to people who may or may not be their relatives and entrusted to them, but basically they are servants to the families. They are not sent to school. When I lived in Senegal, in hindsight, I can realize that there are young women who cooked and cleaned in the household where I had lunch every day, who were originally from another country, Mali, neighboring country. They were Bambara women who were technically slaves to the family where I was eating. And these girls were not paid. They didn't get to go to school as the other children in the household. And they cooked and cleaned as long as the family needed them. And I was talking with an American friend of mine the other day, and when the families no longer need them, they're just dismissed. And they don't have any savings, they haven't accumulated any money, they haven't benefited from education. So slavery exists in many forms, not just sexual exploitation, but in exploitation of young people in many parts of the world.
Can you explain or distinguish between, make a distinction between chattel slavery, indentureship, and apprenticeship?
Okay. Chattel slavery, as practiced in the United States, you are born into slavery and you become a slave for many generations. Indenture was a practice in the United States and elsewhere where you had a contract for a certain number of finite years after which you were free. You were not enslaved or a servant in perpetuity. In some of our northern United States states, such as New York and New Jersey.
You just dropped a very big word. Could you go back to that word and explain perpetuity?
Forever. Certainly,
so
forever.
What do you mean by that?
If your mother and or father were slaves and had you as a child, you would be a slave until you die, forever, and your children would be slaves. There was no ending point of your being a slave.
And when did this practice become? When was this practice established?
It was established by law in the United States, certainly before the American Revolution. Slavery was well established in many parts of the United States before the country was created, and it was viewed as normal. It was part of the law that existed under British law. French had laws around slavery. Spain had laws around slavery. And it was viewed as normal. When you had apprenticeship, when you had indenture, you might be brought over on a...
Hello? Okay, he dropped out. We're waiting for Mr. John Franklin to call back. He should be calling us back any minute. We were talking about an image of four women that are over 400 years old celebrating Emancipation Day in Washington, D.C. And we just wanted to learn more about these different celebrations that we've lost in our culture. And he's explaining now about indentureship, chattel slavery, and apprenticeship. When he calls back, I'd like to ask Mr. John Franklin from the Smithsonian Museum about Anthony Johnson, an indenture servant from the 1600s, early 1700s, who became very wealthy in Virginia. And this all happened once the country had changed from indentureship to chattel slavery. And he's an expert, so I am very eager to hear his answer. So I hope he will be calling us back. Until then, I'm going to put on some music, so be patient with us, and I apologize for the technical difficulties. Hello, Mr. Franklin, you're back?
Yes, I'm back. I said hello, and I have lost you.
Yes, and it was just getting so interesting. I was like, Mr. Franklin? But anyway.
Well, I said hello, and I lost you, so I called back.
Yes, well, I'm glad you called back. You were just explaining apprenticeship. You explained indentureship and chattel slavery. You were moving on to apprenticeship.
Yes, and I explained that apprenticeship is usually to learn a skill of some kind. You learn to be a silversmith. You learn to be a carpenter. You learn to be a midwife. You learn to be a seamstress. You learn to be a chef. And so you're given by a relative, usually. This has nothing to do with slavery, necessarily. People apprentice now to a person until you master that skill. And there are levels of being, newly skilled, and then you eventually become a master craftsperson in whatever the skill is.
Well, I asked that question because when I read Benjamin Franklin's biography,
mm-hmm.
I was surprised that he was, indentured to his brother at something like a printing press, and he escaped.
Right, right.
And I was just amazed that they were practicing, that white people were practicing something similar to slavery amongst their own relatives. And he
right.
literally escaped and was afraid on a boat to be captured and identified as an escapee.
Well, not everyone had the opportunity to go to college or school. And so there were other ways that people learned a trade, and was often by apprenticeship. What I think you missed in what I was continuing to discuss was that when slavery was officially ended in New York and New Jersey, for example, if you were a young person, let's say you were 12 or 13, when freedom was announced in 1803, there was a period of apprenticeship for formerly enslaved young men and women until they were a certain age, or, for example, until you're 21 or until you're 30, in which you continue a status between being a slave and being free until you've satisfied whatever that time limit is. And so that's a second use of the term apprenticeship specifically related to slavery. Benjamin Franklin, of course, was not of African descent, and his apprenticeship was for the skill that he was being trained in. And I'm sure, as you said, he escaped. There are other people who escaped. But even today, people who want to become chefs, for example, go and apprentice with a master chef until they attain those skills.
Okay. Now, I had a question about a documentary I viewed several years ago, and I just uploaded it onto my YouTube channel recently, about Anthony Johnson out of Virginia. Are you familiar with Mr. Johnson's story?
I'm not.
Okay. I'll just tell you a little bit, and we'll let the audience do the research. He was a black indentured servant, and he worked out his servitude, and he became a very, very wealthy landowner. And in this documentary, it explains how America, how the colonies went from a labor system of indentureship to chattel slavery. And it talked about the land rights and, things of that nature. But we'll continue with the different celebrations. So you had a meeting recently, and you had a slideshow you were talking about. Could you tell us more about those images that you presented last night?
Yes, the images that some of my panelists brought were of the celebration in Washington, D.C. in 1866. That's the painting that's the etching that I'm familiar with, of people in fancy dress celebrating their freedom from, 4 years previous to that particular celebration. It's an illustration from a newspaper at the time called Harper's Weekly. They also showed photographs of black troops from the Civil War. This is during the emancipation takes place during the Civil War, and an interesting part of I learned yesterday, part of Mr. Lincoln's document was to encourage Africans, if they wanted to leave the United States as free people, there was something called a colonization movement recommending that people either go to the Caribbean as free people or they go to Liberia, which was created as a place to receive formerly enslaved people. And they got on ships and went to Liberia. People from Canada had the opportunity, if they had served the British during the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, to go to Sierra Leone, also in West Africa, as free people from Canada. And so it's very interesting.
I'm sorry, but what was the average amount of time or generations that an African-American would have been enslaved at that time? And I'm asking that because I'm thinking if I knew what part of Africa I came from, I would want to go back home. Like, you know, resettle somewhere that may do the same thing to me, enslave me, just like the America did, you know. Did any of these, you know, did anyone know who was of people?
Well, I read an interesting novel. I just finished it last month called The Book of Negroes. And it's by a black Canadian author. And it's a story of a woman, it's a beautifully written story, of a woman who is captured in the 1700s in her village in Guinea in West Africa and walks for many weeks alongside other people who've been captured to the coast of West Africa where she's eventually put on a ship. And she survives the crossing and ends up in South Carolina. She then is taken to New York City and is in New York City when the Revolutionary War breaks out in 1770s. And then she goes to Canada. And from Canada, she actually makes it all the way back to Africa and tries to find her village and is unsuccessful. So it's a book called The Book of Negroes. It's a very, very powerfully written book.
It reminds me of the story of Amistad, you know.
Yes.
And I'll let you explain the story.
Well, the Amistad is the story of a ship that was a Cuban ship and people from Sierra Leone take over the ship and try to become free. They're unsuccessful. They eventually are taken to Connecticut. And in Connecticut, they learn how to read and write English and eventually make their way back to Sierra Leone. It's a long but very interesting story.
And was that common, you know, when if an African...
Oh, no, it was not at all common.
So when people...
But there were revolts on the ships. There's some very interesting books about the actual time on the slave ship. One book is called The Slave Ship by a man named Rediger, and it looks at the three different parts of the ship trade, of the ship movement. From Europe to Africa, the ship comes with very few people on it, but many goods that will be traded for Africa. Textiles, weapons, ammunition, wine, liquor, iron. And those goods then are brought to these West African coastal towns, and with local chiefs or kings, they trade those goods for Africans. And then the Africans are placed on these ships, which are now empty of the trade goods. And in this phase, which we know as the Middle Passage, it's a floating prison of these men and women restrained. Children on the ship as well, children born on the ship, pregnant women on the ship. And when the ship comes to its port in the Americas, whether it's Brazil or Jamaica or New York or Washington or other places in Central and South America, the people who have survived the crossing are then sold to new owners. And then when the ships are empty of the Africans that they've brought over and they've collected money, the The ship then is loaded with goods from the Americas. If it's from South America, it might be silver or gold. It might be timber. From our region in the United States, it might have been cotton or molasses from sugar or rum. And then those goods are shipped to Europe. We think of really the slave trade as the first globalization. I know we talk a lot about globalization now, but you have a minimum of 12.5 million people taken from Africa, brought to the Americas between 1501 and 1867. And
what role did the gold mine or the 1849 gold rush play in the emancipation of Africans?
None to my knowledge. By the time there are African Americans who go to California, as other Americans do, to be part of the gold rush, to hopefully become rich finding gold in California. We're actually doing an exhibition on a family that came to California in search of gold. An African American family came in search of gold. They were free people. This is 1840. But they were free African Americans in California at that time.
But we were the hottest commodity on the market at that time, during the slave trade, of course.
Right, but
more valuable than Africans.
Well, they're valuable because they weren't being paid for their employment, so that the products that they helped create, be it sugar or tobacco, the prices weren't as high as if they had to pay for that labor. And there are many investors in Europe, both in the trade in European goods and investments in the ships, for people who wanted to become wealthy when these ships come back with money from trading the slaves as well as goods to sell in Europe.
So
now,
how
the sugar...
Revolutionary War, Industrial Revolution... affect the slave trade combined with the gold rush?
Right. Well, I don't think the gold rush is part of it. The industrialization is taking various products and making them easier to produce with machines, such as cotton, for example. Cotton is grown in the south of the United States and in other places. And then it is taken to factories in New England that process the raw cotton into thread and then into fabric that is sold in the United States as well as exported abroad. So because the labor was so cheap, because you're not paying these slaves to either grow the cotton or grow the rice or grow the sugar, then the people who own the slaves sell the products of the slaves at a lower price than if they had to pay them salary. So that's where the profit margin comes in.
So economically speaking, the gold rush and gold being a new hottest commodity and an industrial revolution really had no bearing on slowing down the slave trade and slavery institution itself?
Not to my knowledge. We think of the gold rush as California. There are other times when gold is exported out of the Americas. And indeed, when Christopher Columbus came here and other explorers in the 1400s and 1500s, they were looking for gold and got gold from the Indians and took it back to Europe. So the gold rush starts in 1492, and that's prior to slavery. Because people wanted gold. If you ever have the opportunity to visit the National Museum of the American Indian here at the Smithsonian in Washington, you see that at the moment of 1492 of the so-called discovery, American Indians in Central, North, and South America knew gold, knew how to get gold, and had many objects made out of gold that the Europeans wanted, took, melted down, and made into other gold objects in Europe. So gold is a long-term history. And indeed, there are Africans who are brought to Brazil, close to 6 million Africans are brought to Brazil alone during the slave trade, many of whom have skills in mining, because there were mines in Africa, there was gold in Africa, and there were Africans brought to create and work in the mines, whether they were silver mines or gold mines in different parts of South America. So,
and I'm glad you mentioned the skills. That was one of the reasons they kidnapped Africans, based on not just hard labor and physical labor, but because of the skills. And you talked about apprenticeship.
Well, cotton, for example, is a crop in West Africa that's been grown for thousands of years. People know how to grow it, spin it, weave it, dye it, and make clothing out of it. Cotton is not a European product. And so cotton was produced in Africa, taken across the Sahara Desert into Europe in the medieval ages, and then cotton is produced in the American South, for example, and then shipped to Europe to make European clothes. But the skill and knowledge of how to work with cotton, how to grow it, how to spin it, how to weave it, how to dye it, is an African skill. Similarly, while rice does grow in Asia, the first rice brought to the Americas, whether it's to Haiti or South America or Virginia or Louisiana, are Africans who have been growing rice in West Africa. The French bring people to Louisiana in the 1720s who know how to grow rice, who know how to plant it, irrigate it, harvest it, cure it, and cook it. We all have heard of gumbo, whether we live in Louisiana or not. Campbell soup makes gumbo. But gumbo is actually the French word for okra, and it's a West African dish served with rice that the West Africans brought over. So many of the European planters were actually eating African food.
Right.
I'm sorry, you're asking, what other?
Can you list some more foods? I'm really enjoying this. And I know okra's one. And what about the yam or the sweet potato?
Well, they exist. They're different forms of yam and sweet potato, some of which are in West Africa and some of which are here.
Okay.
It's interesting, you know, when Columbus and other Europeans came here, their fruits and vegetables they discovered here that did not exist in Asia or in Europe or in Africa. Hot peppers are from the Americas. Watermelon is from West Africa. Black-eyed peas are from West Africa. And so when people began traveling, they took hot pepper back to West Africa. They brought mangoes and oranges and other fruits from Asia to Africa and to South America. So there's a very interesting set of books about the exchange of foods that occur in the late 1500s. Potatoes are from South America. You think of the Irish potato, but potatoes were originally from South Africa, South America, from Peru, from Bolivia, and they're exported to Europe, and they start to grow them in Europe.
But then why are we taught that, you know, about Thanksgiving is a time where the Native Americans exchange food with the pilgrims? And,
right. Well, their crops.
Right.
The crops
wouldn't
that are from
like
here.
Right.
That the Europeans needed help learning how to grow so that they would survive these harsh winters. And the corn was a product from here. Tobacco is a product from here. As I said, hot peppers and potatoes are products from the Americas. And while the Atlantic Ocean has the same fish on both sides, the birds here, turkeys are from here. So they've now been exported to other parts of the world, but these pilgrims are discovering turkeys. I've seen some wild up in Massachusetts. And so there's this, you know, tradition of Thanksgiving, but now it's been transformed into all the different foods that different communities have brought after the Indians and British are celebrating the first Thanksgiving.
Okay.
African-American families have their own twist to it. Asian families have dishes that are not part of the European, African, or North American food repertoire.
Wonderful. And I know that you only promised us 15 minutes, and we're way past 15 minutes. But I have to ask you about Christmas Addict and Benjamin Banneker, and then we can close.
Okay.
Christmas Addict, this summer we'll be celebrating the 4th of July. And I'd like to know more about, your sentiments about Christmas Addict and why we as African Americans should celebrate 4th of July or merge it with Emancipation Day, if you think that's possible. And Benjamin Banneker, you started off the show by talking about Washington, D.C., and how the plans were laid out and was originally different plantations. I was watching a show about the different shapes, how the states got its shapes, and I was so disheartened when they showed the rock that Christmas Addicts used when he was surveying Washington, laying it out. Washington.
Benjamin Banneker.
Right? What did you say?
Yeah.
Okay. And it was locked up, literally locked up in a... And I was just upset. I was like, why aren't we celebrating Christmas Addicts more and Benjamin Banneker. So if you could start off with Benjamin Banneker.
Okay. Benjamin Banneker actually grew up in Maryland, and he's one of our first scientists, first American scientists, to say nothing of first black scientists. And there, if you come in Ellicott City, there in Baltimore County, there is a park where Benjamin Banneker grew up. And he learned how to become a surveyor and how to assess land with Mr. Ellicott, for whom Ellicott said his name. And the two of them surveyed the area that already had plantations in it. I'm looking at the map right in front of me, actually. And they decided how to lay out the streets of Washington. There is very near my office a Benjamin Banneker plaque talking about his work in terms of surveying Washington and working with Pierre L'Enfant, who admired the boulevards and streets of Paris and designed Washington similar to the streets of Paris. Now, Christmas Addicts is, of course, someone we hear about as children, the first person to die in the American Revolution. And his significance is that we have an exhibition at the Museum of American History called The Price of Freedom. And people of African descent have fought in every war that has occurred in the United States. And coming all the way back to colonization and the story of D.C. emancipation, many people were opposed to leaving the United States after they were free, even if they were given money to go to the Caribbean or go to Africa, because they said, we have worked and died to be free in this country. Now that we're free and we've paid already in blood, we've fought in previous wars, we're American citizens just like anyone else who's here, we should not have to leave now that we're free. There were certain parts of the community that were afraid that free blacks would have no controls. Well, they're the same laws that control free people of all kinds. So if you break the law, you'll be in violation of the law, and you'll serve time or fine or whatever is appropriate. But people felt that once they had fought in the War of 1812, or fought in the Revolutionary War, or fought in the Civil War for freedom, they should not be forced to leave the country because some people did not want them to remain here.
So as African Americans, should we celebrate the 4th of July and Emancipation Day and Jubilee and Juneteenth all together on that one day?
I don't know if we need to celebrate them together. They're at different times. And I think that...
Are they all in the same spirit?
Some are and some are not. Now, there's a very important speech that I would encourage your listeners to read, to find. Frederick Douglass wrote a speech, an oration as it was called, What is the 4th of July to the American Slave? Because it was celebrating freedom from Britain and the British Crown, but as long as people were still enslaved in a society that respected democracy, he felt there was some hypocrisy in African Americans celebrating the 4th of July. But those days have passed. But there's a wonderful oration, and I would encourage all of your readers to look up or try to find Frederick Douglass's speech about the 4th of July, which he gave before emancipation.
Now, on that note, could you tell us if and when Washington, D.C. is going to have a celebration, and tell us more about your museum and the date that it will be open and how to get in contact with you and the museum?
Certainly. About 10 years ago, the city of Washington began celebrating Emancipation Day again, and people asked me to be part of planning that. And there's an annual parade, which was Monday. There are fireworks. And then there are different conferences and programs for people of all ages. And that's why we had the discussion last night. I had another discussion last week. And there were programs in different parts of the city over the weekend and will be all this week. Our museum was the dream of Civil War black veterans to create first a monument and then a museum in Washington to tell of the contributions of African Americans in creating this society. That's over 150 years ago. And now we are in the process of building a building that was brought into law. It was created by the second President Bush. He appointed a commission. The commission came up with recommendations that this new museum should be built. It should be built as part of the Smithsonian. It is the 19th museum of the Smithsonian, and it's being built at the base of the Washington Monument, facing the White House. President Obama and Mrs. Obama came for our groundbreaking ceremonies on February 22nd of this year, and the leadership of the Smithsonian, the director of our museum, Lonnie Bunch, members of our board, who include Laura Bush, the former First Lady, and a number of business people. It's chaired by Dick Parsons from Time Warner, and the publisher of Ebony Jet. All of them were present. We have the challenge of raising $500 million, $250 million from Congress, and $250 million for the private sector and from individuals to build a building. And then we're in the process of designing exhibitions on the history and culture of African Americans from Africa through getting here on the middle in the Middle Passage, through the periods of slavery and freedom, the fight against segregation, and the period following Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968, right up to the inauguration of President Obama. We're looking at developing exhibitions on music, on theater and other cultural expression, on blacks in sports and in the military. We're looking at different communities of African-American communities across the country at different time periods in an exhibition called The Power of Place. We're looking at the creation of African-American organizations and institutions and the creation of black scientists and inventors and doctors in an exhibition called Making a Way Out of No Way. And we have all of that in the works while we're building. So we're developing exhibitions. We have a gallery in the Museum of American History. And our current exhibition there is called Slavery and Jefferson's Monticello. It is a gallery of 3,000 square feet that we've done in partnership with Monticello, where Mr. Jefferson lived. And we have a mixture of artifacts that the museum has acquired through purchase and through gifts. Objects from the Museum of American History, where the exhibition is housed, and artifacts and documents from Monticello, Mr. Jefferson's home. And that exhibition will be up until October 14th. We have an exhibition that comes after that called Marching to Freedom, which will mark the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, as well as the March of Washington, which took place 50 years ago in 2013. So you can reach us through our website, N for National, M for Museum, AA for African American, HC for History and Culture, nmaahc.si.edu. And that's a Smithsonian website. If you can just look up Smithsonian, you can also look National Museum of African American History and Culture. You can become a member of the organization for as little as $25. We're hoping to have 100,000 members by the time we open. I heard today we're at 28,000 and something. We are looking for the artifacts that help us tell the history and culture of African Americans. And these objects are not just in African American hands, because African American culture and history is important to all Americans, and we're building a museum for all Americans and visitors. We have visitors at the Smithsonian from around the world. So we hope to complete construction in 2014 and then take a year to populate the museum with the exhibition, the cafeteria, the library, the orientation theater, and everything that you want to come and see in late 2015 for free, as all the Smithsonian museums are. Your tax dollars partially help to support that, but we have to raise money for public programs, for exhibitions, and to acquire artifacts. So late 2015, we're saying November 2015, you come on down to Washington for the National Museum of African American History and Culture opening. We are celebrating our groundbreaking a second time this year, June 27th, with a concert on the National Mall, June 27th. I believe we start about 6 p.m. So if you're in the area, please plan on joining us. And in the interim, you can come to the National Museum of American History and go to the Greensboro sit-in lunch counter on the second floor. And right next to the lunch counter is the National Museum of African American History and Culture Gallery, where, as I said earlier, we have the exhibition Jefferson and Slavery and Jefferson's Monticello, The Paradox of Liberty.
Excellent. I really enjoyed this conversation. I learned a great deal. You gave us a list of books to read, and you invited us to a concert, and we would like to have you on again around a week or two before your June concert. Do you think we can possibly book you again?
I'd love to, and there'll be more to share with you at that time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Franklin, and have a great night.
You too.
All right.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.